Harper Audio presents Pirate Latitudes by Michael Crichton, performed by John Bedford Lloyd. Copyright 2009 by Michael Crichton. Production copyright 2009 by HarperCollins Publishers. Part 1. Port Royal. Chapter 1. Sir James Almont, appointed by His Majesty Charles II, Governor of Jamaica, was habitually an early riser. This was in part the tendency of an aging widower, in part a consequence of restless sleep from pains of the gout, and in part an accommodation to the climate of the Jamaica colony, which turned hot and humid soon after sunrise. On the morning of September 7th, 1665, he followed his usual routine, arising in his chambers on the third floor of the governor's mansion and going directly to the window to survey the weather and the coming day. The governor's mansion was an impressive brick structure with a red tile roof. It was also the only three-story building in Port Royal, and his view of the town was excellent. In the streets below, he could see the lamplighters making their rounds, extinguishing street lights from the night before. On Ridge Street, the morning patrol of garrison soldiers was collecting drunks and dead bodies, which had fallen in the mud. Directly beneath his window, the first of the flat, horse-drawn carts of water carriers rumbled by, bringing casks of fresh water from Rio Cobra, some miles away. Otherwise, Port Royal was quiet, enjoying the brief moment between the time the last of the evening's drunken revelers collapsed in a stupor and the start of the morning's commercial bustle around the docks. Looking away from the cramped, narrow streets of the town to the harbor, he saw the rocking thicket of masts, the hundreds of ships of all sizes moored in the harbor and drawn up to the docks. In the sea beyond, he saw an English merchant brig anchored past the quay, near Rackham's Reef offshore. Undoubtedly, the ship had arrived during the night, and the captain had prudently chosen to await daylight to make the harbor of Port Royal. Even as he watched, the topsails of the merchant ship were unreefed in the growing light of dawn, and two longboats put out from the shore near Fort Charles to help tow the merchantmen in. Governor Almont, known locally as James the Tenth, because of his insistence on diverting a tenth share of privateering expeditions to his own personal coffers, turned away from the window and hobbled on his painful left leg across the room to make his toilet. Immediately, the merchant vessel was forgotten, for on this particular morning, Sir James had the disagreeable duty of attending a hanging. The previous week, soldiers had captured a French rascal named Leclerc, convicted of making a piratical raid on the settlement of Ocho Rios, on the north coast of the island. On the testimony of a few townspeople who had survived the attack, Leclerc had been sentenced to be hanged in the public gallows on High Street. Governor Almont had no particular interest in either the Frenchman or his disposition, but he was required to attend the execution in his official capacity. That implied a tedious, formal mourning. Richards, the governor's manservant, entered the room.
"Good morning, Your Excellency. Here is your claret."
He handed the glass to the governor, who immediately drank it down in a gulp. Richard set out the articles of toilet, a fresh basin of rose water, another of crushed myrtle berries, and a third small bowl of tooth powder with the tooth cloth alongside. Governor Almont began his ministrations to the accompanying hiss of the perfumed bellows Richards used to air the room each morning.
"Warm day for a hanging,"
Richards commented, and Sir James grunted his agreement. He doused his thinning hair with the myrtle berry paste. Governor Almont was 51 years old, and he had been growing bald for a decade. He was not an especially vain man, and in any case he normally wore hats, so that baldness was not so fearsome as it might be. Nonetheless, he used preparations to cure his loss of hair. For several years now, he had favored myrtle berries, a traditional remedy prescribed by Pliny. He also employed a paste of olive oil, ashes, and ground earthworms to prevent his hair from turning white. But this mixture stank so badly that he used it less frequently than he knew he should. Governor Almont rinsed his hair in the rose water,
dried it with a towel, and examined his countenance in the mirror. One of the privileges of his position as the highest official of the Jamaica colony was that he possessed the best mirror on the island. It was nearly a foot square and of excellent quality, without ripples or flaws. It had arrived from London the year before, consigned to a merchant in the town, and Almont had confiscated it on some pretext or other. He was not above such things, and indeed felt that this high-handed behavior actually increased his respect in the community. As the former governor, Sir William Lytton, had warned him in London, Jamaica was not a region burdened by moral excesses. Sir James had often recalled the phrase in later years. The understatement was so felicitously put. Sir James himself lacked graceful speech. He was blunt to a fault and distinctly choleric in temperament, a fact he ascribed to his gout. Staring at himself in the mirror now, he noted that he must see Enders, the barber, to trim his beard. Sir James was not a handsome man, and he wore a full beard to compensate for his weasel-beaked face. He grunted at his reflection and turned his attention to his teeth, dipping a wetted finger into the paste of powdered rabbit's head, pomegranate peel, and peach blossom. He rubbed his teeth briskly with his finger, humming a little to himself. At the window, Richards looked out at the arriving ship. "They say the merchantman's the Godspeed, sir." "Oh, yes?" Sir James rinsed his mouth with a bit of rose water, spat it out, and dried his teeth with a tooth cloth. It was an elegant tooth cloth from Holland, red silk with an edging of lace. He had four such cloths, another minor delicacy of his position within the colony. But one had already been ruined by a mindless servant girl who cleaned it in the native manner by pounding with rocks, destroying the delicate fabric. Servants were difficult here. Sir William had mentioned that as well. Richards was an exception. Richards was a manservant to treasure, a Scotsman, but a clean one, faithful and reasonably reliable. He could also be counted on to report the gossip and doings of the town, which might otherwise never reach the governor's ears.
"The Godspeed, you say?"
"Aye, sir," Richard said, laying out Sir James's wardrobe for the day on the bed.
"Is my new secretary on board?"
According to the previous month's dispatches, the Godspeed was to carry his new secretary, one Robert Hacklett. Sir James had never heard of the man and looked forward to meeting him. He had been without a secretary for 8 months, since Lewis died of dysentery.
"I believe he is, sir," Richard said.
Sir James applied his makeup. First he daubed on cerise, white lead and vinegar, to produce a fashionable pallor on the face and neck. Then, on his cheeks and lips, he applied fucus, a red dye of seaweed and ochre.
"Will you be wishing to postpone the hanging?" Richards asked, bringing the governor his medicinal oil.
"No, I think not," Almont said, wincing as he downed a spoonful. This was oil of a red-haired dog, concocted by a Milaner in London, and known to be efficacious for the gout. Sir James took it faithfully each morning. He then dressed for the day. Richards had correctly set out the governor's best formal garments. First, Sir James put on a fine white silk tunic, then pale blue hose. Next, his green velvet doublet, stiffly quilted and miserably hot, but necessary for a day of official duties. His best feathered hat completed the attire. All this had taken the better part of an hour. Through the open window, Sir James could hear the early morning bustle and shouts from the awakening town below. He stepped back a pace to allow Richards to survey him. Richards adjusted the ruffle at the neck and nodded his satisfaction.
"Commander Scott is waiting with your carriage, Your Excellency," Richards said.
"Very good," Sir James said, and then, moving slowly, feeling the twinge of pain in his left toe with each step, and already beginning to perspire in his heavy ornate doublet, the cosmetics running down the side of his face and ears, the governor of Jamaica descended the stairs of the mansion to his coach. Chapter 2.
For a man with the gout, even a brief journey by coach over cobbled streets is agonizing. For this reason, if no other, Sir James loathed the ritual of attending each hanging. Another reason he disliked these forays was that they required him to enter the heart of his dominion, and he much preferred the lofty view from his window. Port Royal in 1665 was a boom town. In the decade since Cromwell's expedition had captured the island of Jamaica from the Spanish, Port Royal had grown from a miserable, deserted, disease-ridden spit of sand into a miserable, overcrowded, cutthroat, infested town of 8,000. Undeniably, Port Royal was a wealthy town. Some said it was the richest in the world, but that did not make it pleasant. Only a few roads had been paved in cobblestones, brought from England as ship's ballast. Most streets were narrow mud ruts, reeking of garbage and horse dung, buzzing with flies and mosquitoes. The closely packed buildings were wood or brick, rude in construction and crude in purpose. An endless succession of taverns, grog shops, gaming places, and bawdy houses. These establishments served the thousand seamen and other visitors who might be ashore at any time. There were also a handful of legitimate merchant shops and a church at the north end of town, which was, as Sir William Lytton had so nicely phrased it, seldom frequented. Of course, Sir James and his household attended services each Sunday, along with a few pious members of the community. But as often as not, the sermon was interrupted by the arrival of a drunken seaman, who disrupted proceedings with blasphemous shouts and oaths, and on one occasion, with gunshots. Sir James had caused the man to be clapped in jail for a fortnight after that incident, but he had to be cautious about dispensing punishment. The authority of the governor of Jamaica was, again in the words of Sir William, as thin as a parchment fragment and as fragile. Sir James had spent an evening with Sir William after the king had given him his appointment. Sir William had explained the workings of the colony to the new governor. Sir James had listened and had thought he understood, but one never really understood life in the new world until confronted with the actual rude experience. Now, riding in his coach through the stinking streets of Port Royal, nodding from his window as the commoners bowed, Sir James marveled at how much he had come to accept as wholly natural and ordinary. He accepted the heat and the flies and the malevolent odors. He accepted the thieving and the corrupt commerce. He accepted the drunken, gross manners of the privateers. He had made 1,000 minor adjustments, including the ability to sleep through the raucous shouting and gunshots, which continued uninterrupted through every night in the port. But there were still irritants to plague him, and one of the most grating was seated across from him in the coach. Commander Scott, head of the garrison of Fort Charles and self-appointed guardian of courtly good manners, brushed an invisible speck of dust from his uniform and said, "I trust Your Excellency enjoyed an excellent evening and is even now in good spirits for the morning's exercises."
"I slept well enough," Sir James said abruptly. For the 100th time, he thought to himself how much more hazardous life was in Jamaica when the commander of the garrison was a dandy and a fool instead of a serious military man.
"I am given to understand," Commander Scott said, touching a perfumed lace handkerchief to his nose and inhaling lightly, "that the prisoner Leclerc is in complete readiness, and that all has been prepared for the execution."
"Very good," Sir James said, frowning at Commander Scott.
"It has also come to my attention that the merchantman Godspeed is arriving at anchor even as we speak, and that among her passengers is Mr. Hacklett, here to serve as your new secretary."
"Let us pray he is not a fool like the last one," Sir James said.
"Indeed, quite so,"
Commander Scott said, and then mercilessly lapsed into silence. The coach pulled into the high street square where a large crowd had gathered to witness the hanging. As Sir James and Commander Scott alighted from the coach, there were scattered cheers. Sir James nodded briefly. The commander gave a low bow.
"I perceive an excellent gathering,"
the commander said.
I am always heartened by the presence of so many children and young boys. This will make a proper lesson for them. Do you not agree?
Hmm, Sir James said. He made his way to the front of the crowd and stood in the shadow of the gallows. The high street gallows were permanent. They were so frequently needed. A low braced crossbeam with a stout noose that hung 7 feet above the ground.
Where is the prisoner? Sir James said irritably.
The prisoner was nowhere to be seen. The governor waited with visible impatience, clasping and unclasping his hands behind his back. Then they heard the low roll of drums that presaged the arrival of the cart. Moments later, there were shouts and laughter from the crowd, which parted as the cart came into view. The prisoner Leclerc was standing erect, his hands bound behind his back. He wore a gray cloth tunic, spattered with garbage thrown by the jeering crowd. Yet he continued to hold his chin high. Commander Scott leaned over.
He does make a good impression, Your Excellency.
Sir James grunted.
I do so think well of a man who dies with finesse.
Sir James said nothing. The cart rolled up to the gallows and turned so that the prisoner faced the crowd. The executioner, Henry Edmonds, walked over to the governor and bowed deeply.
A good morning to Your Excellency and to you, Commander Scott. I have the honor to present the prisoner, the Frenchman Leclerc, lately condemned by the Audiencia.
Get on with it, Henry, Sir James said.
By all means, Your Excellency.
Looking wounded, the executioner bowed again and then returned to the cart. He stepped up alongside the prisoner and slipped the noose around Leclerc's neck. Then he walked to the front of the cart and stood next to the mule. There was a moment of silence, which stretched rather too long. Finally, the executioner spun on his heel and barked,
Teddy, damn you, look sharp!
Immediately, a young boy, the executioner's son, began to beat out a rapid drum roll. The executioner turned back to face the crowd. He raised his switch high in the air, then struck the mule a single blow. The cart rattled away, and the prisoner was left kicking and swinging in the air. Sir James watched the man struggle. He listened to the hissing rasp of Leclerc's choking and saw his face turn purple. The Frenchman began to kick rather violently, swinging back and forth just a foot or two from the muddy ground. His eyes seemed to bulge from his head. His tongue protruded. His body began to shiver, twisting in convulsions on the end of the rope.
All right,
Sir James said finally, and nodded to the crowd. Immediately, one or two stout fellows rushed forward, friends of the condemned man. They grabbed at his kicking feet and hauled on them, trying to break his neck with merciful quickness. But they were clumsy at their work, and the pirate was strong, dragging the other men through the mud with his vigorous kicking. The death throes continued for some seconds, and then finally, abruptly, the body went limp. The men stepped away. Urine trickled down Leclerc's pants legs onto the mud. The body twisted slackly back and forth on the end of the rope.
Well executed indeed, Commander Scott said with a broad grin.
He tossed a gold coin to the executioner. Sir James turned and climbed back into the coach, thinking to himself that he was exceedingly hungry. To sharpen his appetite further, as well as to drive out the foul smells of the town, he permitted himself a pinch of snuff. It was Commander Scott's suggestion that they stop by the port to see if the new secretary had yet disembarked. The coach pulled up to the docks as near to the wharf as possible. The driver knew that the governor preferred to walk no more than necessary. The coachman opened the door and Sir James stepped out, wincing, into the fetid morning air. He found himself facing a young man in his early 30s, who, like the governor, was sweating in a heavy doublet. The young man bowed and said, Your Excellency.
Whom do I have the pleasure of addressing? Almont asked, with a slight bow.
He could no longer bow deeply because of the pain in his leg, and in any case he disliked this pomp and formality.
"Charles Morton, sir, captain of the merchantman Godspeed, late of Bristol."
He presented his papers. Almont did not even glance at them. "What cargoes do you carry?"
"West Country broadcloths, Your Excellency, and glass from Stourbridge, and iron goods. Your Excellency holds the manifest in his hands."
"Have you passengers?"
He opened the manifest and realized he had forgotten his spectacles. The listing was a black blur. He examined the manifest with brief impatience and closed it again.
"I carry Mr. Robert Hacklett, the new secretary to Your Excellency, and his wife," Morton said. "I carry 8 freeborn commoners as merchants to the colony. And I carry 37 felon women sent by Lord Ambritton of London to be wives for the colonists."
"So good of Lord Ambritton," Almont said dryly.
From time to time, an official in one of the larger cities of England would arrange for convict women to be sent to Jamaica, a simple ruse to avoid the expense of jailing them at home. Sir James had no illusions about what this latest group of women would be like.
"And where is Mr. Hacklett?"
"On board, gathering his belongings with Mrs. Hacklett, Your Excellency."
Captain Morton shifted his feet. "Mrs. Hacklett had a most uncomfortable passage, Your Excellency."
"I have no doubt," Almont said.
He was irritated that his new secretary was not on the dock to meet him.
"Does Mr. Hacklett carry messages for me?"
"I believe he may, sir," Morton said.
"Be so good as to ask him to join me at Government House at his earliest convenience."
"I will, Your Excellency."
"You may await the arrival of the purser and Mr. Gower, the customs inspector, who will verify your manifest and supervise the unloading of your cargoes. Have you many deaths to report?"
"Only 2, Your Excellency, both ordinary seamen. 1 lost overboard and 1 dead of dropsy. Had it been otherwise, I would not have come to port."
Almont hesitated. "How do you mean, not have come to port?"
"I mean, had anyone died of the plague, Your Excellency?"
Almont frowned in the morning heat.
"The plague?"
"Your Excellency knows of the plague which has lately infected London and certain of the outlying towns of the land?"
"I know nothing at all," Almont said. "There is plague in London?"
"Indeed, sir. For some months now it has been spreading with great confusion and loss of life. They say it was brought from Amsterdam."
Almont sighed. That explained why there had been no ships from England in recent weeks, and no messages from the court. He remembered the London plague of 10 years earlier, and hoped that his sister and niece had had the presence of mind to go to the country house. But he was not unduly disturbed. Governor Almont accepted calamity with equanimity. He himself lived daily in the shadow of dysentery and shaking fever, which carried off several citizens of Port Royal each week.
"I will hear more of this news," he said. "Please join me at dinner this evening."
"With great pleasure," Morton said, bowing once more. "Your Excellency honors me."
"Save that opinion until you see the table this poor colony provides," Almont said. "One last thing, Captain," he said. "I am in need of female servants for the mansion. The last group of blacks, being sickly, have died. I would be most grateful if you would contrive for the convict women to be sent to the mansion as soon as possible. I shall handle their dispersal."
"Your Excellency."
Almont gave a final brief nod and climbed painfully back into his coach. With a sigh of relief, he sank back in the seat and rode to the mansion.
"A dismal, malodorous day," Commander Scott commented,
and indeed for a long time afterward, the ghastly smells of the town lingered in the governor's nostrils and did not dissipate until he took another pinch of snuff.
Chapter 3.
Dressed in lighter clothing, Governor Almont breakfasted alone in the dining hall of the mansion. As was his custom, he ate a light meal of poached fish and a little wine, followed by another of the minor pleasures of his posting, a cup of rich dark coffee. During his tenure as governor, he had become increasingly fond of coffee, and he delighted in the fact that he had virtually unlimited quantities of this delicacy, so scarce at home. While he was finishing his coffee, his aide, John Cruikshank, entered. John was a Puritan, forced to leave Cambridge in some haste when Charles II was restored to the throne. He was a sallow-faced, serious, tedious man, but dutiful enough. "The convict women are here, Your Excellency." Almont grimaced at the thought. He wiped his lips. "Send them along. Are they clean, John?"
"Reasonably clean, sir."
"Then send them along." The women entered the dining room noisily. They chattered and stared and pointed to this article and that. An unruly lot, dressed in identical gray fustian and barefooted. His aide lined them along one wall, and Almont pushed away from the table. The women fell silent as he walked past them. In fact, the only sound in the room was the scraping of the governor's painful left foot over the floor as he walked down the line, looking at each. They were as ugly, tangled, and scurrilous a collection as he'd ever seen. He paused before one woman, who was taller than he, a nasty creature with a pocked face and missing teeth.
"What's your name?"
"Charlotte Bixby, my lord."
She attempted a clumsy sort of curtsy. "And your crime?"
"Faith, my lord, I did no crime. It was all a falsehood that they put to me and—"
"Murder of her husband, John Bixby," his aide intoned, reading from a list. The woman fell silent. Almont moved on. Each new face was uglier than the last. He stopped at a woman with tangled black hair and a yellow scar running down the side of her neck. Her expression was sullen.
"Your name?"
"Laura Peel."
"What is your crime?"
"They said I stole a gentleman's purse."
"Suffocation of her children, ages 4 and 7, John intoned in a monotonous voice, never raising his eyes from the list.
Almont scowled at the woman. These females would be quite at home in Port Royal. They were as tough and hard as the hardest privateer. But wives? They would not be wives. He continued down the line of faces and then stopped before one unusually young. The girl could hardly have been more than 14 or 15, with fair hair and a naturally pale complexion. Her eyes were blue and clear, with a certain odd, innocent amiability. She seemed entirely out of place in this churlish group. His voice was soft as he spoke to her.
"And your name, child?"
"Anne Sharp, my lord."
Her voice was quiet, almost a whisper. Her eyes fell demurely.
"What is your crime?"
"Theft, my lord."
Almont glanced at John. The aide nodded.
"Theft of a gentleman's lodging, Gardner's Lane, London."
"I see," Almont said, turning back to the girl. But he could not bring himself to be severe with her. She remained with eyes downcast.
"I have need of a woman servant in my household, Mr. Sharp. I shall employ you here."
"Your Excellency,"
John interrupted, leaning toward Almont.
"A word, if you please."
They stepped a short distance back from the women. The aide appeared agitated. He pointed to the list.
"Your Excellency," he whispered, "it says here that she was accused of witchcraft at her trial."
Almont chuckled good-naturedly.
"No doubt, no doubt."
Pretty young women were often accused of witchcraft.
"Your Excellency,"
John said, full of tremulous Puritan spirit,
"it says here that she bears the stigmata of the devil."
Almont looked at the demure, blonde young woman. He was not inclined to believe she was a witch. Sir James knew a thing or two about witchcraft. Witches had eyes of strange color. Witches were surrounded by cold drafts. Their flesh was cold as that of a reptile, and they had an extra tit. This woman, he was certain, was no witch.
"See that she is dressed and bathed," he said.
"Your Excellency, may I remind you, the stigmata—"
"I shall search for the stigmata myself later," John bowed.
"As you wish, Your Excellency."
For the first time, Anne Sharp looked up from the floor to face Governor Almont, and she smiled the slightest of smiles.
Chapter 4.
Speaking with all due respect, Sir James, I must confess that nothing could have prepared me for the shock of my arrival in this port.
Mr. Robert Hacklett, thin, young, and nervous, paced up and down the room as he spoke. His wife, a slender, dark, foreign-looking young woman, sat rigidly in a chair and stared at Almont.
Sir James sat behind his desk, his bad foot propped on a pillow and throbbing badly. Sir James was trying to be patient.
"In the capital of His Majesty's colony of Jamaica in the New World," Hacklett continued, "I naturally anticipated some semblance of Christian order and lawful conduct. At the very least, some evidence of constraint upon the vagabonds and ill-mannered louts who act as they please everywhere and openly. Why, as we traveled in open coach through the streets of Port Royal, if they may be called streets, one vulgar fellow hurled drunken imprecations at my wife, upsetting her greatly."
"Indeed," Almont said with a sigh.
Emily Hacklett nodded silently. In her own way, she was a pretty woman, with a sort of looks that appealed to King Charles. Sir James could guess how Mr. Hacklett had become such a favorite of the court, and that he would be given the potentially lucrative posting of secretary to the governor of Jamaica. No doubt Emily Hacklett had felt the press of the royal abdomen upon her more than once. Sir James sighed.
"And further," Hacklett continued, "we were everywhere treated to the spectacle of bawdy women, half-naked in the streets, and shouting from windows, men drunk and vomiting in the streets, robbers and pirates brawling and disorderly at every turn and—"
"Pirates," Almont said sharply.
"Indeed, pirates is what I should naturally call those cutthroat seamen."
"There are no pirates in Port Royal," Almont said. His voice was hard. He glared at his new secretary and cursed the passions of the merry monarch that had provided him with this priggish fool for an assistant. Hacklett would obviously be no help to him at all.
"There are no pirates in this colony," Almont said again. "And should you find evidence that any man here is a pirate, he will be duly tried and hanged. That is the law of the crown, and it is stringently enforced."
Hacklett looked incredulous.
"Sir James," he said, "you quibble over a minor question of speech when the truth of the matter is to be seen in every street and dwelling of the town."
"The truth of the matter is to be seen at the gallows of High Street," Almont said, "where even now a pirate may be found hanging in the breeze. Had you disembarked earlier, you might have seen it for yourself." He sighed again. "Sit down," he said, "and keep silent before you confirm yourself in my judgment as an even greater idiot than you already appear to be."
Mr. Hacklett paled. He was obviously unaccustomed to such plain address. He sat quickly in a chair next to his wife. She touched his hand reassuringly, a heartfelt gesture from one of the king's many mistresses.
Sir James Almont stood, grimacing as pain shot up from his foot. He leaned across his desk.
"Mr. Hacklett," he said, "I am charged by the crown with expanding the colony of Jamaica and maintaining its welfare. Let me explain to you certain pertinent facts relating to the discharge of that duty. First, we are a small and weak outpost of England in the midst of Spanish territories. I am aware," he said heavily, "that it is the fashion of the court to pretend that His Majesty has a strong footing in the New World. But the truth is rather different. Three tiny colonies, St. Kitts, Barbados, and Jamaica, comprise the entire dominion of the crown. All the rest is Philip's. This is still the Spanish main. There are no English warships in these waters. There are no English garrisons on any lands.
There are a dozen Spanish first-rate ships of the line and several thousand Spanish troops garrisoned in more than 15 major settlements. King Charles, in his wisdom, wishes to retain his colonies, but he does not wish to pay the expense of defending them against invasion.
Hakluyt stared, still pale.
I am charged with protecting this colony. How am I to do that? Clearly, I must acquire fighting men. The adventurers and privateers are the only source available to me, and I am careful to provide them a welcome home here. You may find these elements distasteful, but Jamaica would be naked and vulnerable without them.
Sir James,
be quiet, Almont said. Now, I have a second duty, which is to expand the Jamaica colony. It is fashionable in the court to propose that we instigate farming and agricultural pursuits here. Yet no farmers have been sent in 2 years. The land is brackish and infertile. The natives are hostile. How then do I expand the colony, increasing its numbers and wealth? With commerce. The gold and the goods for a thriving commerce are afforded us by privateering raids upon Spanish shipping and settlements. Ultimately, this enriches the coffers of the king, a fact which does not entirely displease his majesty, according to my best information.
Sir James?
And finally, Almont said, finally I have an unspoken duty, which is to deprive the court of Philip IV of as much wealth as I am able to manage. This, too, is viewed by His Majesty, privately, as a worthy objective. Particularly since so much of the gold which fails to reach Cadiz turns up in London. Therefore, privateering is openly encouraged, but not piracy, Mr. Hakluyt, and that is no mere quibble.
But Sir James...
The hard facts of the colony admit no debate, Almont said, resuming his seat behind the desk and propping his foot on the pillow once more. You may reflect at your leisure on what I have told you, understanding, as I am certain you will understand, that I speak with the wisdom of experience on these matters. Be so kind as to join me at dinner this evening with Captain Morton. In the meanwhile, I am sure you have much to do in settling into your quarters here. The interview was clearly at an end. Hakluyt and his wife stood. Hakluyt bowed slightly, stiffly.
Sir James.
Mr. Hakluyt, Mrs. Hakluyt. The two departed. The aide closed the door behind them. Almont rubbed his eyes. God in heaven, he said, shaking his head.
Do you wish to rest now, Your Excellency? John asked.
Yes, Almont said. I wish to rest. He got up from behind his desk and walked down the corridor to his chambers. As he passed one room, he heard the sound of water splashing in a metal tub and a feminine giggle. He glanced at John.
They are bathing the woman servant, John said.
Almont grunted.
You wish to examine her later?
Yes, later, Almont said. He looked at John and felt a moment of amusement. John was evidently still frightened by the witchcraft accusation. The fears of the common people, he thought, were so strong and so foolish.
Chapter 5. Anne Sharp relaxed in the warm water of the bathtub and listened to the prattle of the enormous black woman who bustled around the room. Anne could hardly understand a word the woman was saying, although she seemed to be speaking English. Her lilting rhythms and odd pronunciations were utterly strange. The black woman was saying something about what a kind man Governor Almont was. Anne Sharp had no concern about Governor Almont's kindness. She had learned at an early age how to deal with men. She closed her eyes, and the sing-song speech of the black woman was replaced in her mind
by the tolling of church bells. She had come to hate that monotonous, ceaseless sound in London. Anne was the youngest of three children, the daughter of a retired seaman turned sailmaker in Wapping. When the plague broke out near Christmas time, her two older brothers had taken work as watchmen. Their jobs were to stand at the doors of infected houses and see that the inhabitants inside did not leave the residence for any reason. Anne herself worked as a sick nurse for several wealthy families. With the passing weeks, the horrors she had seen became merged in her memory. The church bells rang day and night. The cemeteries everywhere became overfilled. Soon there were no more individual graves, but the bodies were dumped by the score into deep trenches and hastily covered over with white lime powder and earth. The dead carts, piled high with bodies, were hauled through the streets. The sextons paused before each dwelling to call out, "Bring out your dead." The smell of corrupted air was everywhere. So was the fear. She remembered seeing a man fall dead in the street, his fat purse by his side, clinking with money. Crowds passed by the corpse, but none would dare to pick up the purse. Later the body was carted away, but still the purse remained, untouched. At all the markets, the grocers and butchers kept bowls of vinegar by their wares. Shoppers dropped coins into the vinegar. No coin was ever passed hand to hand. Everyone made an effort to pay with exact change. Amulets, trinkets, potions, and spells were in brisk demand. Anne herself bought a locket that contained some foul-smelling herb, but which was said to ward off the plague. She wore it always. And still the deaths continued. Her eldest brother came down with a plague. One day she saw him in the street. His neck was swollen with large lumps and his gums were bleeding. She never saw him again. Her other brother suffered a common fate for watchmen. While guarding a house one night, the inhabitants locked inside became crazed by the dementia of the disease. They broke out and killed her brother with a pistol ball in the course of their escape. She only heard of this. She never saw him. Finally, Anne, too, was locked in a house belonging to the family of a Mr. Sewell. She was serving as nurse to the elderly Mrs. Sewell, mother of the owner of the house, when Mr. Sewell came down with the swellings. The house was quarantined. Anne tended to the sick as best she could. One after another, the family died. The bodies were given over to the dead carts. At last, she was alone in the house, and by some miracle, still in good health. It was then that she stole some articles of gold and the few coins she could find and made her escape from the second-story window, slipping out over the rooftops of London at night. A constable caught her the next morning, demanding to know where a young girl had found so much gold. He took the gold and clapped her in Bridewell Prison. There she languished for some weeks until Lord Ambrotton, a public-spirited gentleman, made a tour of the prison and caught sight of her. Anne had long since learned that gentlemen found her aspect agreeable. Lord Ambrotton was no exception. He caused her to be put in his coach, and after some dalliance of the sort he liked, promised her she would be sent to the New World. Soon enough, she was in Plymouth, and then aboard the Godspeed. During the journey, Captain Morton, being a young and vigorous man, had taken a fancy to her, and because in the privacy of his cabin he gave her fresh meats and other delicacies, she was pleased to make his acquaintance, which she did almost every night. Now she was here, in this new place, where everything was strange and unfamiliar. But she had no fear, for she was certain that the governor liked her, as the other gentlemen had liked her, and taken care of her. Her bath finished, she was dressed in a dyed woolen dress and a cotton blouse. It was the finest clothing she had worn in more than 3 months, and it gave her a moment of pleasure to feel the fabric against her skin. The black woman opened the door and motioned for her to follow.
"Where are we going?"
"To the governor."
She was led down a large, wide hallway. The floors were wooden but uneven. She found it strange that a man so important as the governor should live in such a rough house. Many ordinary gentlemen in London had houses more finely built than this. The black woman knocked on a door, and a leering Scotsman opened it. Anne saw a bedchamber inside. The governor, in a nightshirt, was standing by the bed, yawning. The Scotsman nodded for her to enter the room.
"Ah," the governor said, "Mistress Sharp, I must say, your appearance is considerably improved by your ablutions."
She did not understand exactly what he was talking about, but if he was pleased, then so was she. She curtsied, as she had been taught by her mother.
"Richards, you may leave us."
The Scotsman nodded and closed the door. She was alone with the governor. She watched his eyes.
"Don't be frightened, my dear," he said in a kindly voice. "There is nothing to fear. Come over here by the window, Anne, where the light is good." She did as she was told. He stared at her in silence for some moments. Finally he said, "You know at your trial you were accused of witchcraft."
"Yes, sir, but it is not true, sir."
"I'm quite sure it is not, Anne. But it was said that you bear the stigmata of a pact with the devil."
"I swear, sir," she said, feeling agitation for the first time. "I have nothing to do with the devil, sir."
"I believe you, Anne," he said, smiling at her. "But it is my duty to verify the absence of stigmata."
"I swear to you, sir."
"I believe you," he said, "but you must take off your clothes."
"Now, sir?"
"Yes, now." She looked around the room a little doubtfully. "You can put your clothes on the bed, Anne."
"Yes, sir."
He watched her as she undressed. She noticed what happened to his eyes. She was no longer afraid. The air was warm. She was comfortable without her clothing.
"You are a beautiful child, Anne."
"Thank you, sir."
She stood, naked, as he moved closer to her. He paused to put his spectacles on, and then he looked at her shoulders.
"Turn around slowly."
She turned for him. He peered at her flesh. "Raise your arms over your head." She raised her arms. He peered at each armpit. "The stigmata is normally under the arms or on the breast," he said, "or on the pudenda." He smiled at her. "You don't know what I am talking about, do you?" She shook her head. "Lie on the bed, Anne." She lay on the bed.
"We will now complete the examination," he said seriously.
And then his fingers were in her hair, and he was peering at her skin with his nose just a few inches from her quim. And even though she feared insulting him, she found it funny. It tickled, and she began to laugh. He stared angrily at her for a moment, and then he laughed, too, and then he began throwing off his nightshirt. He took her, with his spectacles still on his face. She felt the wire frames pressing against her ear. She allowed him to have his way with her. It did not last long, and afterward he seemed pleased, and so she was also pleased. As they lay together in the bed, he asked her about her life and her experiences in London and the voyage to Jamaica. She described for him how most of the women amused themselves with each other or with members of the crew, but she said that she did not, which wasn't exactly true, but she had only been with Captain Morton, so it was very nearly true. And then she told about the storm that had happened, just as they had sighted land in the Indies, and how the storm had buffeted them for 2 days. She could tell that Governor Almont was not paying much attention to her story. His eyes had that funny look in them again. She continued to talk anyway. She told about how the day after the storm had been clear, and they had sighted land with a harbor and a fortress and a large Spanish ship in the harbor, and how Captain Morton was very worried about being attacked by the Spanish warship, which had certainly seen the merchantman. But the Spanish ship never came out of the harbor.
"What?"
Governor Almont said, almost shrieking. He leapt out of bed.
"What's wrong?"
"A Spanish warship saw you and didn't attack."
"No, sir,
she said.
We were much relieved, sir.
Relieved?
Almont cried. He could not believe his ears.
You were relieved? God in heaven, how long ago did this happen?
She shrugged.
3 or 4 days past.
And it was a harbor with a fortress, you say?
Yes.
On which side was the fortress?
She was confused. She shook her head.
I don't know.
Well, Almont said, throwing on his clothes in haste, as you looked at the island and the harbor, was this fortress to the right of the harbor or the left?
To this side, she said, pointing with her right arm.
And the island had a tall peak, a very green island, very small?
Yes, that's the very one, sir.
God's blood, Almont said. Richards! Richards! Get Hunter!
And the governor dashed from the room, leaving her lying there, naked on the bed, certain that she had displeased him, and began to cry. Chapter 6 There was a knock at the door. Hunter rolled over in the bed. He saw the open window and sunlight pouring through. Go away, he muttered. Alongside him, the girl shifted her position restlessly but did not awake. The knock came again. Go away, damn your eyes! The door opened and Mrs. Denby poked her head around.
Begging your pardon, Captain Hunter, but there's a messenger here from the governor's mansion. The governor requests your presence at dinner, Captain Hunter. What shall I say?
Hunter rubbed his eyes. He blinked sleepily in the daylight. What is the hour?
5 o'clock, Captain.
Tell the governor I will be there.
Yes, Captain Hunter. And Captain?
What is it?
That Frenchman with the scar is downstairs looking for you.
Hunter grunted. All right, Mrs. Denby. The door closed. Hunter got out of bed. The girl still slept, snoring loudly. He looked around his room, which was small and cramped, a bed, a sea chest with his belongings in one corner, a chamber pot under the bed, a basin of water nearby. He coughed, started to dress, and paused to urinate out of the window onto the street below. A shouted curse drifted up to him. Hunter smiled and continued to dress, selecting his only good doublet from the sea chest and his remaining pair of hose that only had a few snags. He finished by putting on his gold belt with a short dagger, and then, as a kind of afterthought, took one pistol, primed it, rammed home the ball with the wadding to hold it in the barrel, and slipped it under his belt. This was Captain Charles Hunter's normal toilet, performed each evening when he arose at sunset. It took only a few minutes, for Hunter was not a fastidious man. Nor, he reflected, was he much of a Puritan. He looked again at the girl in the bed, then closed the door behind her and went down the narrow, creaking wood stairs to the main room of Mrs. Denby's inn. The main room was a broad, low-ceilinged space with a dirt floor and several heavy wooden tables in long rows. Hunter paused. As Mrs. Denby had said, Levasseur was there, sitting in a corner, hunched over a tankard of grog. Hunter crossed to the door.
Hunter!
Levasseur croaked in a thick, drunken voice. Hunter turned, showing apparent surprise.
Why, Levasseur, I didn't see you.
Hunter, you son of an English mongrel bitch!
Levasseur, he replied, stepping out of the light, you son of a French farmer and his favorite sheep. What brings you here? Levasseur stood behind the table. He had picked a dark spot. Hunter could not see him well, but the two men were separated by a distance of perhaps 30 feet, too far for a pistol shot.
Hunter, I want my money.
I owe you no money, Hunter said, and in truth he did not. Among the privateers of Port Royal, debts were paid fully and promptly. There was no more damaging reputation a man could have than one who failed to pay his debts or to divide spoils equally. On a privateering raid, any man who tried to conceal a part of the general booty was always put to death, Hunter himself had shot more than one thieving seaman through the heart and kicked the corpse overboard without a second thought.
"You cheated me at cards," Levasseur said.
"You were too drunk to know the difference."
"You cheated me. You took £50. I want it back."
Hunter looked around the room. There were no witnesses, which was unfortunate. He did not want to kill Levasseur without witnesses. He had too many enemies. "How did I cheat you at cards?" he asked. As he spoke, he moved slightly closer to Levasseur.
"How? Who cares a damn for how? God's blood, you cheated me!"
Levasseur raised the tankard to his lips. Hunter chose that moment to lunge. He pushed his palm flat against the upturned tankard, ramming it back against Levasseur's face, which thudded against the back wall. Levasseur gurgled and collapsed, blood dripping from his mouth. Hunter grabbed the tankard and crashed it down on Levasseur's skull. The Frenchman lay unconscious. Hunter shook his hand free of the wine on his fingers, turned, and walked out of Mrs. Denby's inn. He stepped ankle-deep into the mud of the street, but paid no attention. He was thinking of Levasseur's drunkenness. It was sloppy of him to be so drunk while waiting for someone. It was time for another raid, Hunter thought. They were all getting soft. He himself had spent one too many nights in his cups or with the women of the port. They should go to sea again. Hunter walked through the mud, smiling and waving to the whores who yelled to him from high windows, and made his way to the governor's mansion.
"All have remarked upon the comet, seen over London on the eve of the plague," said Captain Morton, sipping his wine. "There was a comet before the plague of 56 as well."
"So there was," Almont said. "And what of that? There was a comet in 59 and no plague that I recall."
"An outbreak of the pox in Ireland," said Mr. Hacklett, "in that very year."
"There is always an outbreak of the pox in Ireland," Almont said, "in every year."
Hunter said nothing. Indeed, he had said little during the dinner, which he found as dreary as any he had ever attended at the governor's mansion. For a time he had been intrigued by the new faces, Morton, the captain of the Godspeed, and Hacklett, the new secretary, a silly, pinch-faced prig of a man, and Mrs. Hacklett, who looked to have French blood in her slender darkness and a certain lascivious animal quality. For Hunter, the most interesting moment in the evening had been the arrival of a new serving girl, a delicious, pale, blonde child who came and went from time to time. He kept trying to catch her eye. Hacklett noticed and gave Hunter a disapproving stare. It was not the first disapproving stare he had given Hunter that evening. When the girl came round to refill the glasses, Hacklett said,
"Does your taste run to servants, Mr. Hunter?"
"When they are pretty," Hunter said casually. "And how does your taste run?"
"The mutton is excellent,"
Hacklett said, coloring deeply, staring at his plate. With a grunt, Almont turned the conversation to the Atlantic passage his guests had just made. There was a description of a tropical storm, told in exciting and overwrought detail by Morton, who acted as if he were the first person in human history to face a little whitewater. Hacklett added a few frightening touches, and Mrs. Hacklett allowed that she had been quite ill. Hunter grew increasingly bored. He drained his wine glass.
"Well, then," Morton continued, "after 2 days of this most dreadful storm, the third day dawned perfectly clear, a magnificent morning. One could see for miles, and the wind was fair from the north. But we did not know our position, having been blown for 48 hours. We sighted land to port and made for it."
A mistake, Hunter thought. Obviously, Morton was grossly inexperienced. In the Spanish waters, an English vessel never made for land without knowing exactly whose land it was. The odds were the Don held it.
"We came round the island, and to our astonishment we saw a warship anchored in the harbor. Small island, but there it was, a Spanish warship, and no doubt of it.
We felt certain it would give chase.
And what happened? Hunter asked, not very interested.
It remained in the harbor, Morton said, and laughed. I should like to have a more exciting conclusion to the tale, but the truth is it did not come after us. The warship remained in the harbor.
The Don saw you, of course, Hunter said, growing more interested.
Well, they must have done. We were under full canvas.
How close by were you?
No more than 2 or 3 miles offshore. The island wasn't on our charts, you know. I suppose it was too small to be charted. It had a single harbor with a fortress to one side. I must say we all felt we had a narrow escape.
Hunter turned slowly to look at Almont. Almont was staring at him with a slight smile.
Does this episode amuse you, Captain Hunter?
Hunter turned back to Morton. You say there was a fortress by the harbor?
Indeed, a rather imposing fortress, it seemed.
On the north or south shore of the harbor?
Let me recollect. North shore. Why?
How long ago did you see this ship? Hunter asked.